this is a question answer period for Tim and Mark, and now Mark, I'll start out with you. It seems that the container ship got a little bit too big. They kept trying to drive the economics of scale associated with larger and larger container ships, but it got too big, and now it's slower and less successful. Shouldn't we expect to move back towards a smaller container ship that's more nimble and more cost-effective? It reminds me a little bit about what happened in airplanes. You know, I think in the last couple of weeks, both Airbus and Boeing announced the end to the 747 production and moving towards 727 and 787s, a smaller a plane that was more efficient economically and fuel-wise, and allowed for moving between smaller airports instead of using these hub terminals. Do you think that the airplane story is consistent with the container ship in terms of the forward trend of shipping?
A couple of points here. First, I'd be careful about the less successful part. Shipping rates have gone up a great deal in the past couple of months, and the main reason for that is that the surviving companies have driven a lot of their competitors out of the market. The world market now is dominated by essentially four groups of companies because many smaller ship lines can't afford to build these giant ships. They couldn't keep pace, and either they went bankrupt or they sold out, and now the market has been consolidated by people who have much more control than they did before. I think your analogy with the giant airplanes is absolutely a correct one. That's being reflected some places in the shipping industry. We're seeing companies that are not going to order these ships that can carry 11 or 12,000 containers. They're ordering ships that can carry 8 or 9,000 containers. And the smaller ships, which are still big by traditional standards, but they're a lot more versatile. They can go on different ports, different routes, and many people in the shipping industry feel that these are actually going to be, over the long run, much more efficient than these super giant ships.
Tim, just to bring you in, what are you seeing right now in terms of relative shipping and port activity on the West Coast versus the East Coast? In the East Coast, we do most of our trading with Europe, on the West Coast predominantly with the Chinese. Are we seeing dramatic differences between port activity? Is Europe really in a severe recession while China is not? What are we seeing?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair characterization. I mean, we are seeing a few East Coast ports where volumes have started to come back and are starting to grow from an import perspective. And typically we just talk about the loaded imports. And so, you know, Savannah was up about 16% in the latest, you know, in September, and was up 5% in August. So that was, you know, had a first half that was down about 7 or 8%. So from that perspective, it looks pretty good. Charleston is also back to flat, and you know, New York's back to growth as well. So we are seeing signs of a European recovery. I don't think we would see the signs for another few months of any effects from sort of a second wave of closures there. I think that would take a little bit of time from a lead time perspective to hit the data. So that's certainly a possibility. I wouldn't say the East Coast port data is looking as good as the West Coast. West Coast is certainly surging in a more sort of concerted way, and so it does seem like, you know, China has come back sort of faster, but no, Europe looks pretty good as well. Now, from an export perspective, we're still seeing a lot of weakness across the board. It doesn't vary too much by region, except for, you know, the Pacific Northwest.
Does that mean that the stimulus bill that we've done has allowed Americans to buy imported goods from all over the world, yep, but that the economies in Europe and Asia are still suffering?
I mean, certainly all the economies of the world are still under, you know, pretty significant pressure. I mean, the stimulus helps in the short term, but those benefits are fading, especially here. But you know, it does seem likely that after the election, you know, some more stimulus will help. But I think just the reopening, the continued reopening, will help things to continue to recover from a domestic standpoint. And you know, as we see, hopefully with risks, you know, falling as the potential for a vaccine becomes more likely. We're kind of expecting the second quarter to be pretty widely available. Is just the rough assumption at this point, and I think that will drive hopefully a global you know, concerted recovery, and I think that's fair to expect.
Question from Mark.
I think you need to be careful about this idea of the East Coast ports being tied to Europe. In fact, the East Coast ports compete pretty directly with the West Coast ports, and that's happening in a couple of different ways. One is that ships can now come through the wider Panama Canal, larger ships, and so the question is, what's the total cost of getting your goods to market from China if you're sailing them to Savannah or Hampton Roads or New York, rather than to Long Beach and putting them on a train in either place. And so a certain amount of cargo is coming through the canal to the East Coast rather than going to the West Coast. Also in Asia, manufacturing is moving away from China toward points south, particularly India, but also Bangladesh, even a little bit of Pakistan now. And a cargo from those places may make it to New York more quickly than to ports on the West Coast. So the East Coast ports are actually much more tied into Asian trade now than they were a few years ago.
Could you, Mark, expand a little bit on your comments about just-in-time inventory in the sense that it seemed like we were going into the golden age of just-in-time inventory where we could keep little to no parts, but we've had a number of experiences often caused by natural disasters where you become dependent on a certain number of parts where the whole system goes down. And has that learning meant that just-in-time inventory isn't a particularly good idea and that we should rely more on domestic suppliers?
People have really moved away from just-in-time inventory because it has risks that they really didn't appreciate. We went through a period of probably 30 years in which both for manufacturers and for retailers, the level of inventory relative to sales was going down month by month. That has reversed, at least until the pandemic scrambled things up a little bit. A part of that reversal, as Tim noted, is due to just-in-time delivery, but a lot of it is really due to risk aversion. If you're not sure the goods are going to get delivered on time, you just have to keep more stuff in your warehouse. And so I think we're seeing that, and we're seeing companies being cautious.
This big low interest rates are helping too, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. This isn't necessarily leading to production coming to the United States per se. The way you deal with some of these risks is to have redundancy. What does redundancy mean? Well, one thing it means is that you move away from having a single factory somewhere that makes a critical component. You're getting things from multiple places. So if for whatever reason a factory goes down, a port goes down, a ship line goes down, you have alternatives and you can still get your goods delivered on time. And companies are paying a whole lot more attention to that than they were a few years ago.
Oh, that makes good sense. Tim,
can
a question
I ask,
for you.
Mark, can I ask Mark one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious about you. About your view on, I mean, you've touched on it, of course, but your view on this idea of reshoring to the U.S., you know, bringing manufacturing back because the risks of globalization have risen so much from a variety of perspectives over the last few years. I mean, it seems like, based on your comments, that's impossible. But I'm curious as to, you know, what do you think when you read about, you know, articles that say, you know, U.S. manufacturing is going to have a great recovery because we're going to bring all this manufacturing back?
There's certainly some industries in which you're going to see some reshoring because the government wants it and is going to pay for it. And you see that in discussions about pharmaceuticals today, where there's pressure to have some kinds of pharmaceuticals made in their entirety in the United States. And that will happen, and it will be supported by the U.S. government. In general, I think what we're moving toward globally is not so much reshoring as regionalization. And you're seeing that very much in the trade figures, that there's more or less a China-Northeast Asia nexus and a Germany-Europe nexus and an Americas nexus. And so production goes on within these smaller geographic areas, and maybe you make the same product in two or three of these regions rather than having all the production in one place. And then if for whatever reason there's an interruption, you can use one region to service the market in the other region. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that the manufacturing will come back to the United States, but it may mean increased manufacturing in Central America, Colombia, Mexico, the Caribbean, other places that are close to the United States. And in the longer run, you do see that wage costs matter less and less in manufacturing. And after all, that's why this stuff went offshore in the first place, right? Production workers were cheaper in other countries. But with labor costs being relatively unimportant in very highly automated factories, that removes a big reason for going offshore.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Question for Tim. Tim, you mentioned that spot prices for trucking is up substantially year on year. At a time of one of the biggest economic downturns that in our lives by far, it's quite shocking. And the reason you said is because drivers are not are off the market. One of the reasons, of course, is that the government is paying people not to work. And so if they could choose not to drive and get nearly as much wages or more wages than they would driving, I could see why they would stay home. But the typical driver is 55 years old, may have some comorbidities. Do you think that's what's leading these drivers to stay home? Is it health risks, or is it the economics associated with the stimulus bill?
Yeah, in such a cyclical industry like trucking, you do have a sort of marginal population of drivers who are near retirement age, and you know they tend to come into the market when spot rates go up, and you know, high prices are the cure for high prices, right? And then they come in and the rates eventually go down. Maybe they go enjoy their retirement. But I think it's a lot harder to convince those drivers to come back this year. And certainly until there's a widely available vaccine, that's going to continue to be the case. But I do think there's a number of other sort of important factors. The number of net new entrants to the labor market each year has been dropping for the past few years, and that's going to continue into mid-decade. So, you know, we're having sort of elevated retirements just demographically. And next, as I mentioned, is that the Drug and Alcohol Clearinghouse, which, you know, we don't have a comparison for how many, drivers failed drug tests last year, but we know from this monthly report that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is now putting out that as of September, there's been 40,000 positive tests. And, you know, it does seem like...
Out of how many drivers?
Well, there's... If you include all CDLs, it's probably in the 3 million range. Just like highway...
That doesn't sound very much. That's a 1%.
Well, if you just look at the highway market, the on highway, medium and long haul kind of stuff, that's only 1.3 million. It's not huge. It's, but I do think it's a factor. And then construction is really good right now. It's a fairly substitutable profession, and so I think that's pulling some drivers as well.
Okay, thank you.